the air. If that's important to you, please make a contribution right now on the web at willpledge.org or call 217-244-9455.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. This year marks the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty. So throughout 2014, we're talking about what poverty looks like in America now. We're asking things like, who is most likely to be poor today? And what effect does poverty have on people's lives? And we're hearing different ideas about solutions. Today, we focus on the criminal justice system, and most people seem to know by now that even being charged with a crime or detained for an alleged crime can have serious economic consequences. Arrests can lead to missed work, loss of a job, and even homelessness long before a case even goes to trial. And even though poor defendants are assigned public defenders at no cost, that's not always enough for them to navigate the criminal justice system effectively. A legal organization in New York called the Bronx Defenders hopes to change that. Executive Director Robin Steinberg is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you only assist low-income Bronx residents. Why the Bronx, if I may ask?
It's the poorest borough in New York City and the most under-resourced and underserved in the city, so we thought that would be the most appropriate place to put our office.
And what are some of the issues that caused you to kind of think through this way of working with clients? I mean, for example, I think most people have seen by now, there have been certainly a lot of movies about it, certainly a lot of books written about this whole question of your right to a defense, even if you don't have the money to pay for a lawyer. So what is it that you do differently?
What we realized when we got to the Bronx in 1997 and we began to watch the impact that the criminal justice system was having on our clients in the Bronx, we realized that lots of other areas of people's lives were being impacted beyond the criminal case. So what we saw was clients who were being evicted because they'd been arrested, children being removed from their home because they had been in the criminal justice system, people risking deportation, losing their benefits, losing their jobs. We began to sort of understand the collateral impact of criminal justice involvement and created a model to respond to that knowledge.
So one of the people who found themselves in need of your services is Anthony. He's a commercial exhaust cleaner in New York, and at his request, we're not using his last name. But he's with us now to tell us a little bit about how your organization helped him. So Anthony, welcome to you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
So I understand that you had a verbal altercation right,
yeah,
with the mother of your children. You said mm-hmm. there was some pushing involved. You were arrested. Mm-hmm. And after 2 days in jail, you faced three different cases.
Mm-hmm.
Right. What were they?
They were a criminal case, family court case, and my immigration case.
So what happened? I mean, when all this happened, had you ever had any contact with the criminal justice system before?
No. No, so this is my first time.
Were you scared?
Yeah.
What was going through your mind when you were arrested and you realized you were going to face three charges? I mean, I guess the first thing I'm curious about
is,
did you have the
this.
Money for... Okay, well...
You know, 33 and first time going through the system and stuff like that. Like, I never been arrested when I was younger, so to be a grown man and having to deal with cases and stuff like that is stressful, you know?
Were you worried you were going to lose your job?
Yeah.
Because you felt at the time out of...
Yeah, the time out of work and the whole situation with the immigration also, it affects it. And, you know, not showing up for at least a day or two, they usually get rid of guys who don't show up. Mm-hmm. It's not a job where it's you need any kind of special background. So a guy off the street could actually walk in and put in an application. So,
how was Bronx Defenders able to help you?
They saved me from going to jail, from doing any time. I'm doing programs now. I didn't think I would be offered a program. I thought I actually would have been locked up right now, you know, serving my time and stuff like that, or even deported.
You were offered a program. What does that mean? Like some sort of a non-prison alternative, what, anger management or some kind
of
anger management, counseling help you deal with your situation? With
exactly.
Your
my
other
kid's
half.
Mother, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, Robin, tell us a little bit more about how you addressed Anthony's situation.
His experience in the criminal justice system is unfortunately fairly typical. Somebody can be arrested for a misdemeanor, which is a rather minor crime in New York, and come into the system for the first time like he did at 33, and all of a sudden realize that not only are they facing the possibility of going to jail and a criminal conviction, but they're facing the possibility of being deported to a country that they haven't lived in since they were children, losing their kids to the family court system, and in his case, losing a job that he cared about very deeply. But our advocates who worked together on interdisciplinary teams were able to sit down with him and really problem solve where all the areas were that might be affected by this one arrest, and how we could protect him from some of the devastating consequences of that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the role the criminal justice system can play in perpetuating poverty in this country. And our guests are Robin Steinberg, executive director of the Bronx Defenders. That's a legal organization that helps low-income defendants, not just with their specific cases, but with all that goes with being in the criminal justice system. And Anthony, a client of the organization. So one other thing you were telling us, Robin, is that sometimes people plead guilty hoping that it'll get them through the system faster, even if they aren't guilty. Is that true?
It's absolutely the case. People plead guilty because they can't come back to court over and over again. People sometimes plead guilty because they can't afford to post the bail that's been set by a judge, and so they plead guilty so they can go home. They plead guilty because they're scared. They plead guilty because they're humiliated and demoralized and don't want to keep coming back, and they just want to get it over with, which is an understanding human emotion, right? It's understandable that somebody would want to just put something behind them. But unless the advocates are working together in a holistic way and talking to clients and empowering them with the information for them to understand all the ways in which their lives and their families' lives will be impacted, people can make a terrible mistake by pleading guilty, even to a minor misdemeanor.
Tell me more about that, though, because I think a lot of middle-class people will have had the experience of saying, admitting to a parking ticket or a traffic ticket that they think they don't deserve just to get it over with.
Well, it's a big deal because a criminal conviction, even for a minor offense, can actually stigmatize you for the rest of your life. And sometimes when you're facing the decision about, do I plead guilty and go home or do I stay in the system, that's hard to think about what the impacts are down the road. Traditional public defender models really focus exclusively on the criminal cases, but we need to really define what we do much more broadly so that we can actually also empower clients with the information about all those other areas that are impacted.
Anthony, do you mind if I ask you a tough question? Mm-hmm. Some people are going to be listening to our conversation, and they're going to be saying that the people who are most often affected by inappropriate behavior mm-hmm. are other people who are poor. And mm-hmm. so they're going to be wondering, like, why it is in society's best interest for somebody like you to not be in jail. I mean, if you did, now I'm asking what happened because I wasn't there, and mm-hmm. the matter has been addressed. But if there was some situation between you and your children's mother that mm-hmm. where you did do something wrong, mm-hmm. some people might feel, well, you know, maybe you should be locked up. And I just wanted to ask you if you would say why you feel it's in society's best interest that you do something else other than be locked up.
I don't think a person should face actual jail time for an argument. Like, they don't really do an investigation and stuff like that to say, oh, this person is lying or something like that, because that's how the case finally ended up. Like, they realized in family court that it was all just words, you know, just anger at the moment. So she said what she wanted to say, and they took down the report. You know.
So the idea was, though, that you're now in some sort of diversion program where if you successfully complete it, then your record will be clean? Is that
yeah.
it? Because
yeah.
you're a first offender and because it was not considered a serious, like a...
Well, in the family court, that's the way it stands. As long as I finish the program, then I have a clear record for family court.
And the program does what for you? Teaches you some better ways to address your disputes?
Exactly, to handle the communication mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I really learned a lot within listening to the programs and see where a lot of it probably started out with the arguing and the take responsibility more for the relationship, you understand? Instead of using the you phrase, you just use the I languages, you know, I believe that we need to talk or something like that instead of you, because that's what triggers most arguments at home, you know, between men and women.
Oh, yeah. I see. Robin, do you want to take that question as well? I mean, people mm-hmm. would say, well, okay, so... You know, you're weighing in on behalf of people who are of low income, who are accused of crimes, but other people say that the people who are generally the targets are also other low income people. So why is it to society's benefit that you're weighing in so heavily on this side?
Well, I think what Anthony touched on is an interesting point. The truth is that while middle class and upper class communities might get parking tickets, those communities are not the communities that are being targeted by the police. Those aren't the communities that the criminal justice system polices. Mm-hmm. What's conduct in one community, that same conduct is not deemed criminal in another community.
That's true.
And in large measure, that is about class and that's mm-hmm. about race. And so people get into arguments, even heated arguments, all the time mm-hmm. in middle and upper class communities across New York City. But you don't see them being hauled into the criminal justice system.
Yeah, but maybe their spouses aren't calling the police.
It raises an interesting question about if you're living in a disenfranchised community or community that's been historically suffering from all the symptoms of poverty, there aren't a lot of options for reaching out for help. So people that are in low-income communities will often rely on administrative systems like the police department to get help because they don't have other resources available to them. But that doesn't mean that the conduct is only going on in those communities. Rather, those are the communities being targeted by the police. And that creates an inequality in and of itself that really needs to be addressed. You know, defending somebody like Anthony and empowering him to make choices about looking at the criminal case, understanding the deportation consequences, looking at what the impact is it might have on his family or his job, and then allowing him to make the decisions about what's in his best interest and what, frankly, is in his family's best interest and his community's best interest by having all that information. Look, at the end of the day, everybody's better off. If Anthony gets the services that he needs, he's able to stay in this country with his children and his family. He's able to support them by going to a job, right? He's able to get the help with some of the issues that he wanted help with in terms of learning better communication styles and his intimate relationships. Mm-hmm. That's better not just for him. That's better for society. It's better for his family. It's better for his community. It's better for all of us.
Before we let you go, Anthony, do you have a final thought?
The lawyers there at Bronx Defenders, they're something different. Like, I didn't think a public defenders would fight for you the way they did, you know. I always thought that you need a paid lawyer for when you get into serious trouble like I did. And, you know, being that they just came and helped out and they didn't even know me, so they actually sat down and we conversated, became really, really a good thing for me.
Anthony is a commercial exhaust cleaner in New York. He's a client of the Bronx Defenders. Robin Steinberg is the executive director of the Bronx Defenders, and they were both kind enough to join us in our bureau in New York. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the fees attached to those prepaid debit cards may seem small, a dollar here or there, but our money coach Alvin Hall says those costs add up.
This seems, on the surface of it, to be an easier way to manage your money. It's not.
We'll try to find out how to get some clarity on prepaid debit card fees. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear from people who really make you think, like astrophysicist Brian Greene explaining the scientific theory that our universe is just one of many.
And the image that I like to have in mind is, imagine that our universe is like one slice of bread in a much grander cosmic loaf, with the other slices of bread being other universes.
No subject is too big for Fresh Air. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by the Center for Advanced Study, presenting Can the Islamic Sharia Be Constitutionalized? By Nathan Brown on Tuesday, April 8th at 4 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our Money Coach conversation. That's the part of the program where we talk about the economy and personal finance. Today we want to talk about debit cards, specifically prepaid debit cards, because more and more people are using them, some to avoid traditional banking institutions, some to have more control over their spending and to avoid debt. But not all of these cards are the same, especially when it comes to the fees they charge. We want to talk more about this, so we've called, once again, our money coach, Alvin Hall. Welcome back, Alvin.
I'm glad to be back.
So tell me about the prepaid debit cards, and why are they so popular now?
Prepaid debit cards are really popular among low-income people who don't have access to traditional banks. They want to use their money, but they don't want to pay all of these fees to go to one of the check cashing places. They could lose their check. And this seems, on the surface of it, to be an easier way to manage your money.
But you're saying it's not?
It's not. This whole period here right now reflects very much something I saw in the 1980s. In the 1980s, a large number of people started to put money into mutual funds, and it's parallel to the growth that people are seeing in debit card use, as well as prepaid debit card use. So it's growing by huge amounts.
So why are these items attractive to banks? I mean, presumably they're already getting fees from the debit cards that are attached to their traditional checking accounts. So why are these prepaid debit cards attractive to the issuing institutions?
Because of the number of users that they expect to have by, let's say, 2016, and they're seeing so much growth. And remember, I have this motto, that where there is money, there's always creativity. And so now they're splicing and slicing these fees to create more fees. There are fees for activating your cards. There are fees for reloading your cards. There are fees for monthly maintenance, fees to get paper statement, fees to check your balance, fees for customer service. You go on and on. I looked at a broad range of card and I found 10 fees that you could be subject to. And it depends upon how they slice and dice them and how they put them together that reflects your card. And there's no consistency across the board.
Is that really the key issue here? Is it? It's really hard for consumers to compare between different instruments. Let's say you want to open up a traditional checking account. You can go to Bank A and Bank B and you can compare, or credit union, and compare side by side. This is how much for checks. This is how much if it goes below a certain balance. Why is it harder to compare this with prepaid debit cards?
Because there's no uniform way of displaying the fee in a chart format that everyone can understand and quickly compare the rates. The Pew Charitable Trust has proposed this sort of chart format, but it's voluntary, not mandatory. It needs to be made mandatory, just the way it was in the mutual fund industry in the 80s. Michelle, there's nothing really new about this. In the 80s, we had fee madness in the mutual fund industry. Now we have fee madness in the prepaid debit card industry. And the way they solved that in the mutual fund industry was to come up with a standard format where everything that had to be laid out in a particular way so that the average investor could compare easily. They need to bring that same knowledge, that same wisdom and experience to the prepaid debit card market.
As I understand it from the reporting in the Washington Post, the Post article says that prepaid cards are also attractive for banks because they're exempt from an amendment in Dodd-Frank. This is a bill that kind of overhauled a number of issues in the financial services industry that restricted the amount that banks could earn from and credit card fees. So I guess one person's loophole is another person's opportunity.
Exactly.
Well, you're saying that there's no requirement that this information be kind of transparent and easy to understand.
None
but
whatsoever.
I thought that there was a plain language requirement in this earlier law. It doesn't apply here?
Not nearly the same way. So in preparation for this, I decided to go out and get some prepaid debit cards. You can look at these things. Some of the important text is so small, I'd have to have a magnifying glass to read it. How they present it is so different from one card to the next. There's no uniformity at all. And therein lies the problem. It is truly a buyer beware market.
So what are some of the things that they charge fees for?
Let's see. Let us be creative here. First, we can imagine that they charge a monthly maintenance fee. That's reasonable. But what about for card replacements? They charge for that. When you call up customer service because you have a problem, there is a charge for that. In some cases, although this is declining, when you use the card to buy something and they swipe it, there's also a fee associated with that. Some of them charge you if you use your debit card in the same network of ATM, although that is declining at the moment.
And I understand that there is some legislation being considered this. I understand that Senator Mark Warner, a Democrat of Virginia, has proposed a bill that would require financial institutions to more clearly disclose prepaid card fees. But we understand that there was such a pitched battle over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to begin with. We can't predict. So in the absence of that, what does a consumer do?
I tell the consumer to go to places like Consumer Reports and other third-party agencies like this that evaluate these types of cards and rate them from best to worst. Do not expect the card that you have today to be the best card in 6 or 8 months. So you're going to have to constantly look and check and make yourself aware, because the creative people at these firms, they see cash flow.
So the brand of a particular institution that you may have had a pre-existing relationship with, and I'm not going to name any particular one, but just because you've had a good experience with a particular instrument 6 months ago, you're saying means nothing.
It means nothing, because they may decide that the marketplace has changed, they've reached a certain critical mass of number of users, therefore they can take away this particular benefit that benefit those users, because they figure these people probably won't go anyplace else. They are comfortable there and they're less likely to move.
Is there anybody else? Consumer Reports, you're saying, is one way to evaluate these kinds of instruments, which is a nonprofit.
Exactly.
Anybody else?
I would look at places like Bankrate.com. I'd even look at some of the business magazines that routinely rate these cards over a period of time. And there must be websites out there that I don't know about that also offer comparisons. The key thing is constantly look. Don't assume that the card you have today will be as good in 6 months or a year from now.
Alvin Hall is an author and personal finance educator. He joined us from our studios in New York City. Alvin Hall, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here about this important topic to so many people.
And now it's time for Muses and Metaphor. That's our ode to National Poetry Month. All through April, we are featuring original tweet-length poems, 140 characters or less, delivered by Twitter and written by NPR listeners and, new this year, some of our regular contributors. We have gotten off to a great start. According to the Twitter analytics site Topsy, we have had more than 2,500 tweets on the TMM Poetry hashtag. They are still coming in. We were really excited to hear from Native American poet Hyde Erdrich. Here's her Twitter poem, inspired by the North Dakota landscape.
Whirlwinds glitter, flat rivers snake her cleft of low cliffs, cold, lonely, lovely, then green grass sweet, who would not want to eat.
That was Native American poet Hyde Erdrich. And here to tell us more about the series is poet Holly Bass, who's helped us in each of the last 4 years that we've been doing it. Holly Bass, welcome.
Hi, welcome. It's so great to be back.
As I mentioned, this is your fourth year participating in Muses and Metaphor. One of our regular contributors, Fernando Espuelas, is a talk show host on Univision, a successful businessman. He said this is the hardest assignment that he has had in years. On the other hand, Hyde Erdrich told us she loved the 140 character limit. What about you?
It's definitely challenging, but, you know, who doesn't like a good challenge?
Some people. Well, thank you for taking the challenge. You've started a teen writing initiative at a detention center, and you've been working with your students to create Twitter poems. How do they feel about it?
They like it, but they also think it's, you know, really difficult. So what I tell them to do is just write a whole poem, and then you can take one line or two lines from that poem and turn that into your Twitter poem.
Do you have one to share with us?
I do, actually. This is, we did Metaphor and we did I Am poems, and here's some lines from the girls. I am a plant with no seeds, fiending for soil. I am a good witch with no spells.
Nice. Very nice. Was that a group effort or does it have one?
It was a group effort.
Very nice. Very nice. What do you like about it?
I like the contrast. So one of the things we talked about is how do you turn an emotion into a metaphor? So you could start with something like feeling powerless, and then that becomes a good witch with no spells. And so how do you visualize powerlessness in a creative and unique way? And so that's how we came up with some of those lines.
Mm, that was lovely. Now, you've also been monitoring the submissions on Twitter, which you do every year for us, which we appreciate very much. What stood out for you?
Well, I think this year, being the fourth year, what I really loved was the sense of coming back to a sort of reunion, like a poet's reunion. And all these people who maybe I've never met in person, seeing their Twitter poems over and over, it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, you're back. Yay.
That's wonderful. Of course, original poems they're delivering to us, right?
Yes.
Okay. So do you have one or two for us?
I do. I have one.
That's the wonderful pleasure of this, is because they're so short. You can always share.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's been a lot of nice exchange. So the poet I'm going to read from actually took one of my poems and translated it into Tagalog, which I thought was fabulous. And so it's my pleasure to read this poem by Sue Layug. Marbled waterscape, mosaic of fields. The great river has witnessed birds, seeds, humans, stories before migration was a word.
Lovely.
Yeah,
I love
isn't that,
that
just beautiful?
That.
There's a whole sort of ecosystem within those 140 characters.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask if you would give us share a poem with us. But before I do, do you have some advice for people who would kind of like to try it and might be a little intimidated by it?
I think, again, it's easier to cut away. If you think of it as sort of like a big chunk of marble, and that's very intimidating, but you just start to cut away, cut away, cut away until you get something that emerges from that. So I would say write from your heart and focus on vibrancy of language and then distill down.
Do you think about picking how do you pick a subject? I mean, do you think about just like what's on your mind, like what's bothering you or something you feel or happen to feel or something you want to get off your chest?
Absolutely. I think poetry is a great way to process the day. A lot of poets I know, they do a haiku every morning. And so you could think of it as a meditation and a way of processing. I've been writing poems about working in the detention center because there's a lot that I'm processing. So I find that very helpful.
Well, tell us about the poem you are about to share with us, your original Twitter poem.
Absolutely. And so I'm very proud about this one. You have to let me nerd out for five
let's
seconds,
hear it.
Right?
Let's
because
hear it.
It's in iambic tetrameter. Okay. And it's a Twitter poem. So I thought that was kind of cool to do both. So most of us are familiar with iambic pentameter. You hear that in Shakespeare. My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. Or Elizabeth Barrett Browning, how do I lovely? Let me count the ways. So the iam is that combination of unstressed and stressed syllables, the da-da, 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 da-da. So that would be iambic pentameter when you have five of those pairs. Tetrameter is simply four of those pairs.
Okay.
So you hear the rhythm, da-da, 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 da-da. Okay, and here we go. To tweet, to sing, to send out sound, to na pomo, to write each day, to read, to meet, retweet, to wit, to spring, to hash, to tag, to play.
I love it. Thank you. That was Holly Bass. She is a writer and a poet, and she was kind enough to join us once again in our Washington, D.C. studios. Holly Bass, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We still want to hear from you. Tweet us your poems. They have to be 140 characters or less. Use the hashtag TMMPoetry. You might have heard that some of our listeners actually joined Twitter just to participate in our Twitter poetry series. You might call it their big break into poetry. Well, our colleagues at All Things Considered have been hearing stories from a number of people about the moment when their careers in other fields took off. The series is called My Big Break, and as part of the series, they recently spoke with actor Ken Jeong. You might know him as Senor Chang in the NBC show Community and the bad guy, Mr. Chow, in the Hangover series of movies. But before that, he was known by his patients as Dr. Jeong.
Internal medicine was my specialty, basically general practice with an emphasis on adult medicine. During the day, I was a doctor. At night, I was a comic, and it was really just to let off some steam. It just became my golf, in many ways. Most doctors have golf as a hobby. Mine was doing comedy. I never let on I was a comedian. I never acted out. It was really important to me, to not be Patch Adams. I was so super serious as a doctor. I would bark orders to my nurses. I was hardcore. I wanted to make sure I did my job right. I was perfectly trained to be a physician. It wasn't a fluke. I worked hard at it. Once I started appearing on television, one of my first appearances was on BET Comic View.
Give it up. But Dr. Ken, y'all.
I would just go to wherever they were filming in L.A. and they would just record my set. And it was my kind of introduction to television.
I got a day job just like you guys, all right? I'm a doctor. I'm a medical doctor. We got to talk different at work, right? Hi, I'm Dr. Jeong. I'll be your primary care provider.
That kind of one thing, of my right? patients did see me She was an elderly white lady in her late 70s. And she said, "By the way, me and my husband loved you on BET Comic View." And that kind of blew my mind.
Just because I'm a doctor don't mean I'm not a player.
My first big break was getting the part of Dr. Cooney in Knocked Up, which was written and directed by Judd Apatow. He was looking for an Asian actor with medical experience.
Hello, Allison. Ben, interesting night.
We really, really appreciate you coming, man.
Well, what else do I have to do? I mean, besides sleep. Totally kidding.
And that coincided with me leaving medicine. It was kind of time to go. And it was really my wife, who's also a physician. And to her everlasting credit, she said, you know, it's time to pursue this full time. The second part of my big break was The Hangover. I mean, that changed my life overnight. It changed everything for me in terms of my career. And none of us knew that it would be like the biggest R-rated, you know, comedy franchise of all time. I remember telling my wife filming that, "I think I made the funniest movie ever. I just hope people see it."
I want my puss back. That's not a purse, it's a satchel. It's a puss. Okay? And you steal from wrong guy.
Wait a second.
You know, I always say Knocked Up opened the doors and Hangover just burst it wide open. To this day, it's still surreal. And my wife's a doctor. All our friends are doctors, our close friends. And it's just that I have an odd job now. I think I'm like a doctor who had a detour, and I just have an odd job.
That was actor and comedian Ken Jeong. Our friends at All Things Considered want to hear about your big break. Send an email with your story to mybigbreak, all one word, at npr.org. Coming up, lawmakers in Colorado are fighting back against the state's whooping cough outbreak. They want to make it harder for parents to get out of immunizing their children. But should parents be allowed to decide if and when their children get vaccinated? Our parenting panel takes a shot at that question. Ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News, I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. From Inada, crafting shiatsu massage chairs for over 50 years, and makers of the DreamWave Total Body Massage Chair at dreamwavechair.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
As your partner in public radio, WILL seeks to be transparent with you about our fundraising needs. After looking at our fundraising numbers through the third quarter of our fiscal year, we've determined that raising $140,000 during our current radio fund drive will put us back on track to reach our goals. Each gift is incredibly important to maintaining this essential news service for you and everyone in communities throughout Central Illinois. Call 217-244-9455 or go to willpledge.org to lend your support.
Coming to WILL-TV, 50 years after the Dave Clark Five and the Beatles hit the American shores, Great Performances presents a look at the British invasion in The Dave Clark Five and Beyond, Glad All Over. The program features footage from the band's iconic performances on The Ed Sullivan Show, along with never-before-seen footage from Clark's personal archives. Watch The Dave Clark Five and Beyond, Glad All Over, tonight at 7 on WILL-TV.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Inclusive Illinois. Celebrate different abilities at Illinois at the Fashionable Fundraiser 2 in support of the Division of Disability Resources and Educational Services. Today at 6 p.m. at the Krannert Center Lobby.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. Today, we're talking about something you might think is a settled issue, but it is not. We're talking about childhood vaccinations. Researchers at the Centers for Disease Control, that's an agency that tracks health issues and keeps numbers, estimate that 95% of American kindergartners are fully vaccinated, but we want to talk about that 5%. California and New York have seen measles outbreaks, and health officials partly blame parents who did not vaccinate their children. And in Colorado, whooping cough is a growing concern, and some lawmakers want to make it harder for parents to opt out of vaccinations. We wanted to talk more about all this, so we're joined now by Dr. Marilyn McPherson-Corder. She is a pediatrician. She is a professor of pediatrics at Howard University and the University of Maryland, and a mom of two. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Seth Mnookin is author of the book, The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. And he's also a dad of two. Seth Mnookin, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Krista Kafer is a columnist who's been writing about this issue for the Denver Post. Krista, thank you for coming as well.
Great to be here.
And so, Dr. McPherson-Corder, I'm going to start with you because, as I mentioned, you've been practicing for more than 30 years now. And you're also, I also want to mention, you're the director of pediatrics at a local health institution here. And I wanted to ask if more parents are raising concerns about vaccinations. And are they things that you think you're surprised that they're raising?
Yes, they are raising concerns, and I would say they are raising more in the past 5 years, and I feel that lots of that is due to stories they hear on the social media and relatives, as well as just friends, you know. And what I tend to do, I tell them every question is a legit question. I sit them down and I educate them.
What are some of the kinds of questions that they're asking? I mean, they're saying that they've heard that there are toxic substances in the vaccines, or what are some of the things that they're saying to you?
Well, that my child would be brain damaged if they receive certain vaccinations. And we're still hearing, unfortunately, we're still hearing the relationship with autism, even though that report has already been proven to be fraudulent. But we still hear it. We're still getting backlash from it.
And Seth, you spoke to a lot of parents who are not vaccinating children for your book. So talk about this. You actually tried to trace this down and figure out why it is that these stories, rumors, opinions about vaccinations have kind of spread. Tell us what you found out as briefly as you can.
I think there are a couple of reasons. One is there have been these fraudulent reports that have been published. But I think the larger reason is that we're very uncomfortable just as people with introducing something into our body to protect us against a disease that we haven't had yet. And so you combine that with the fact that because of the way our healthcare system is set up, there's not a lot of time for parents to discuss these issues with their doctors. And so they do end up either learning about it on social media and getting misinformation or talking about it at the playground or with other parents. And I think one thing we really need to do is think about how we can bring this conversation, initiate this conversation in a medical setting. So the first exposure parents have to it is one where they're getting accurate information.
We're going to talk about that in a minute. In fact, it's interesting because before we went on the air, Dr. McPherson-Corder was actually talking to us about that very thing. So I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. But Seth, I'm just going to ask you just one of the things that fascinated me, though, about your reporting is a lot of the parents that you reported on were well-educated. I mean, These are not people who did not have access to health practitioners, but they were still getting information from, people who weren't doctors, or they heard about it at the supermarket and something like that. And I was just fascinated by that.
Yeah, I think that stems from a couple of different things. One, I did find that a lot of the parents I spoke with tended to be better educated, better off, more likely to self-identify as politically liberal or environmentally conscious. That's by no means true across the board, but I think that some of what you see is sort of typified by what this one doctor in California has suggested that his patients do if they're anxious about vaccines, and that is, quote, hide in the herd, and essentially take advantage of the fact that most people around you are vaccinated and rely on them to protect your child. And that, to me, is such an incredibly entitled attitude to have. And I think unlike some different issues where you see people ignoring science, this is not one that falls among neat political or class or religious lines.
So Krista, in Colorado, where lawmakers are trying to address this issue in the way that we're going to talk about in a minute, the CDC finds that 15% of kids don't have documented vaccinations. And as we mentioned, that's a lot higher than in the country on the whole. Before you were a columnist, you were an education policy analyst, and you don't oppose vaccinations yourself. But I was curious if you can tell us, why do you think in Colorado that that number is as high as it is?
Well, I imagine that some of those kids are, in fact, vaccinated. But what they, when they take a personal exemption, when their parents take a personal exemption and sign that card, basically some of those kids don't have vaccinations. Some of them do, but the parents don't want to have to go look for the paperwork. So the number might be a little bit high. It's very interesting. I find that it's the case with what Seth was talking about. Some of the parents are very well off and liberal. Some of the parents are conservative. Some of the parents – I mean, the group of people who are not vaccinated is – it's pretty diverse. And as I looked around, it seemed that they fell into two camps, conscientious objectors who were perhaps not vaccinating or not vaccinating using all of the vaccinations. And then there's another group of parents that were either misinformed, believing these you know, so-called science reports linking autism, for example, and also parents that were simply too lazy to go look for the paperwork.
So there's the bill that's being considered in Colorado would force parents to take an online education course before they opt out, if they want to opt out on what's called this personal exemption, as opposed to, say, for example, there's an ingredient in the vaccine which they know their child is allergic to. You know, for example, I mean, some, you know, just like the flu vaccine for some kids, if you're allergic to eggs, that's generally not indicated, although some kids still can sort of tolerate it. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about people who personally opt out. Krista, you're saying the reaction to this is what? Has been what?
Well, we've got three exemptions. We've got medical, we've got religious, and we've got personal. And the personal one is just very easy to take. All you have to do is sign the back of a card. And, you know, some of those parents have done due diligence. They've actually investigated. They've made a conscientious choice. Perhaps they're doing many of the vaccines, but not all of them. They're in contact with their physician. I would say they're doing due diligence. But the fact that it makes it so easy for parents who simply don't want to do due diligence, or who are misinformed, or who are simply either too lazy to vaccinate or too lazy to go look for the paperwork, it really does keep it wide open.
So what's the reaction to this proposal, which, as we said, would force parents to take an online education course if they want to take that personal exemption? Presumably, if there's a medical exemption, then the doctor has certified that the child would be medically harmed by that particular vaccination. But what's been the response to this idea that, you know, you should, you know, force the parents to kind of take some education about what are people saying about that?
Well, the hearing was very boisterous. A lot of people testified on both sides. Again, it was not a homogenous group of people. There were people on the left and the right. And I spoke to the lead opponent before I wrote my column, and I thought it was interesting. They were basically saying that it is discriminating against a group of people who conscientiously determine not to use vaccines. And I, even though I'm 100% pro-vaccination, I ended up coming out against the bill because I was uncomfortable with the idea that we have to force people who are objecting from a particular medical practice from, you know, that we would force them to take a online government-generated course. That was what I was uncomfortable with. I would rather see a robust private sector initiative to educate parents, to really get to those misinformed parents or those parents who I probably shouldn't call them lazy, but parents who either aren't looking for the paperwork or who are not doing the vaccinations.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about childhood vaccinations in our parenting roundtable, and we're talking about what has become a surprisingly, perhaps surprising to some, perhaps persistent and robust debate about childhood vaccinations, at least among some parents. I'm joined by columnist Krista Kafer. That's who was speaking just now. She wrote about the issue for the Denver Post. Also joining us, Seth Mnookin, author of The Panic Virus, and Dr. Marilyn McPherson-Corder. She's a pediatrician and a professor of pediatrics. So Dr. McPherson-Corder, what about that? I mean, what do you think about that? The approach being contemplated in Colorado?
Well, you know, because we are spending less time because of the demand and for access with our patients, I feel that it's important. I think it's a good idea to inform, to have that website or that training, because that way they'll know what they're saying no to. As a matter of fact, I even feel that when you're pregnant, you need to see it, because there are certain things that right once you are once you deliver, the vaccinations start, so that they'll know what they're saying no to. Many a time, that's not the case. They just don't know.
So you're saying you actually, in your prenatal visits, when people are shopping for, looking around for a pediatrician, people often visit while they're pregnant. When you have those initial visits, what do you say?
And I encourage that initial visit. And what I tell them the practice of pediatrics and what we do and what's recommended with CDC, developmental milestones, et cetera. And I hand out at that encounter, even before the baby is born, I hand out the immunization sheets, the CDC information, so that they'll know. Because anticipatory guidance is very important in this case. And so they see that and they're like, wow, we may talk 15, 20 minutes, but we get that point across and we begin the educational discussion that's necessary.
Seth Mnookin, what about that? I mean, do you think that these anti-vaccine parents that you spoke with might be persuaded by this? What's your take on it?
Well, I think there are a couple of distinctions. One, there's this very small but very fervent group of parents that I think really accurately can be described as anti-vaccine. They tend to get more attention than they probably deserve because they're very well organized and very vocal. If all of those parents didn't vaccinate, that would not be an issue because it really is such a minuscule number. The real issue is the much larger number of parents who are anxious and don't know what to think. And I'm very, very much in favor of prenatal interventions. In fact, it's one of the things that I wrote about a couple of years ago in the Washington Post. And the reason that I think that is such a important time to start delivering that information is because when I went to those first appointments after our son was born, I was barely standing up. You know, our child wasn't sleeping. He was crying all the time. I was not in a position where I could take in information. For our prenatal visits, my wife and I had our notebooks out and had a list of questions and were writing down answers. I think that's a much better time to initiate that conversation.
Do you think, Seth, that part of that is a kind of we're in an anti-authority age, is that if some authority figure tells you something, you're kind of more likely to not want to hear it? And I'm just wondering if you think that that's part of it.
Well, it certainly seems that this is tapping into some of that. What you tend to find in surveys and studies is that even parents who have a negative view of the healthcare system or of the medical system overall tend to view their own doctors positively. So I think it's a little bit hard to tease out how that actually affects their decisions, but certainly there's an enormous difference between our relationship with doctors and all sorts of people in authority today than there was 20 or 30 years ago, when I think as a society we were much more likely to go along with what we were essentially told to do. I think that is one current that's going on here.
Chris, can I ask you to refer to something that Seth mentioned earlier, which is that there's now kind of a backlash to the backlash against vaccines, which is that there are parents who are now becoming very annoyed and saying that these kids who are not getting their vaccinations are either free riders or they are jeopardizing their kids with diseases that should have been eliminated by now. And I'm just wondering if there's been some discussion about that. How do you mediate that? How is that being discussed?
Well, I'm glad that these parents are speaking out. There's a website, I think it was Voices for Vaccines, that I looked at, where it has some very poignant stories, because there are kids that are either too young to be vaccinated or who have been vaccinated but the vaccine didn't take, and they are at risk of getting these diseases once they've made an entry into the population. And keeping that herd immunity high is essential. We really want to have as many kids vaccinated as possible. And so I'm glad that parents are hearing these other voices, because I think the scare tactics are out there and we need voices to combat that.
But Dr. McPherson, yes. A final thought from you on this, because we're talking mainly about childhood vaccinations, which are generally delivered in early childhood, but now there's another debate over Gardasil, I believe is the trade name, which is given to older girls. Now, some people are starting to object to that. They feel it hasn't been sufficiently tested, or other people feel that it's either kind of a... they feel like it's a kind of stigmatizing. It's almost like implying that their girls are going to be sexually active, and they're annoyed about that. And so I just wanted to ask your thoughts about something, how we should be talking about this next wave of...
Right. Well, before I say that, I want to also bring this out, that I've had two or three families that do not get their child vaccinated. And one of the problems we ended up having, one child had whooping cough, went to the emergency room, and refused or did not tell the pediatrician that they were unvaccinated. When I spoke to the doctor, because I always call to make sure that I know what's going on with my patient, I said, this is an unvaccinated child. And that put everyone at risk. in the ER as well as elderly people, et cetera. Going back to the Gardasil, yes, we have a direct correlation with cervical cancer and HPV, as well as throat cancer and HPV. So what I say to my parents, who now I feel about 50 to 60% are accepting and requesting versus 20% maybe 3 or 4 years ago, that this is something that we can eradicate, we can prevent. And I would like to make sure that each and every one of my patients, male and female, are protected from cervical cancer, from throat cancer, their loved ones, et cetera. So it's coming into a discussion that we're not talking about sexual activity anymore. I mean, sure, down the road, but we're saying this would prevent them when they are. So we're not saying your child is precocious and having these activities, and we're talking about down the road.
Do you think 5 years from now, we only have a minute left, Dr. McPherson-Corder, do you think 5 years from now we'll still be talking about this, or do you think this is just one of those interim sort of inflection points in history, something we had to get over so that we started talking about vaccination again? What's your thought?
I think we will be over it, especially now that we're seeing outbreaks of other conditions that should have been eradicated. So my hope is that we would be past this.
Dr. Marilyn McPherson-Corder is a pediatrician, a professor of pediatrics, and a mom of two. She was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios, and she still has her her white coat on, and she's actually going right back to their office. Krista Kafer is a columnist for the Denver Post. She was with us from Denver. And Seth Mnookin is the author of The Panic Virus and a father of two. He's also associate director of the science writing program at MIT, and he joined us from there. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.